From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When the National Security Agency's secret wiretapping program first came to light last year, the government reassured us that the program was limited strictly to terrorists and their associates. But on Thursday, we learned, courtesy of USA Today, that Uncle Sam is, in fact, watching you, or at least the phone numbers you dial. The report alleges that since 9/11, AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South have been feeding call records to the NSA, which is building, in one source's words, the largest database ever assembled in the world. President Bush immediately went on TV not to deny the charge, but to state yet again that the government was acting within the law. If anyone's at fault, he suggested, it's the blabbermouths who spoke to the press.
As a general matter, every time sensitive intelligence is leaked, it hurts our ability to defeat this enemy.
Got that, USA Today? In recent weeks, the New York Times and the Washington Post have also been criticized by Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, among others, for their Pulitzer Prize-winning exposés of NSA wiretapping and CIA prisons in Europe. Some say the papers could be in violation of the 1917 Espionage Act. But George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley says they're just doing their jobs.
The media in the last few years has done precisely what the First Amendment was designed to do. That is, reporters have brought to the public operations that have been viewed as criminal by many experts. The response of the administration is equally classic. They're suggesting that these reporters could be charged criminally, and there's been suggestions that Congress increase the penalties for journalists. We also have some very disturbing prosecutions, like the AIPAC case, where the administration is arguing that even hearing classified information can violate the Espionage Act.
Well, let's talk about the AIPAC case. What are the legal implications there for reporters and the rest of us, and where does that stand?
Well, you have these two gentlemen who work for AIPAC. This is the lobbying organization that works for the interests of Israel. And they had meetings with a gentleman by the name of Franklin, who passed along orally classified information. Franklin was prosecuted for that. And indeed, not many people objected to the argument that he could be prosecuted. He had knowingly released classified information. However, there was a significant jump in arguing that the people who received the information orally could also be prosecuted. It's an argument that puts all reporters at potential risk.
Well, let's get back to the USA Today story. I'm curious about how you see Congress's role in all of this. As soon as the story broke, there was a flurry of pledges from senators and representatives that phone company executives would be hauled up to Capitol Hill for a thorough grilling. On the other hand, this surveillance program has allegedly been going on for 4.5 years. Shouldn't Congress have already figured out what was going on?
I think what this story demonstrates quite vividly is that there is no oversight in Congress. You know, we had the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee recently say with regard to the NSA domestic surveillance program that she didn't think it was her job to look into whether the operation was lawful. And many of us were left scratching our heads. We weren't sure what she thought her job was.
And we're talking about the other surveillance program that was exposed by the New York Times some time ago.
That's right. I mean, I've actually come to the conclusion that we'd be better off without the intelligence committees because there is no oversight. It gives the false impression of oversight, which is even worse.
And to drive home the point, this week the Justice Department announced it had dropped its own investigation of the NSA wiretapping program because its investigators had been repeatedly denied security clearances to get information about the program.
I know. That's just it's perfectly bizarre.
Well, what about the legal exposure of the phone companies? There was a case recently brought against AT&T. The government invoked the state's secrets privilege increasingly, especially since 9/11. Whenever the Justice Department comes in and says, this is a state secret, we cannot discuss this in open court, the judges will almost always agree and the case gets shut down.
That case is going to raise a very interesting question, because what the government is trying to do is to invoke the privilege over an operation that many of us in this area believe was a federal crime. Now, clearly, when the court created this privilege, it never intended it to be used to shield criminal conduct by an administration.
So, Jonathan, to what extent does the media's right to report on these secret programs hinge on the legality of those programs themselves? If the attorney general, for instance, follows through on his threat to haul journalists into court for violating the Espionage Act, would a judge first have to determine if the programs were legal?
I think that they probably would. They could simply look at the question of whether this is a matter of great public interest. The White House is basically saying that regardless of whether what they did was a crime, it was still a classified crime, and therefore you can be prosecuted for even hearing about it and reporting on it. We have a long history of the government classifying criminal acts and negligence to try to keep it from the public eye. Now, the reason journalists are so exposed in the federal system is that Congress has refused to pass a federal shield law, a law that gives protection to journalists, that allows them to refuse to turn over their sources in a grand jury, for example.
So there's no protection at all. All they've got basically are the public and the Pulitzer Prize Committee.
That is basically true. And what's disturbing is that because Congress has become virtually comatose, reporters are the only check now on this government. And so it's a great irony that they have never been more exposed.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
My great pleasure.
Jonathan Turley is a law professor at George Washington University.
The letter from Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to George Bush was released on Monday morning and broke an epistolary freeze between the two countries' leaders nearly three decades long. What the letter lacked in clarity, it made up for in length, 18 pages of U.S. foreign policy criticism, defensiveness, and religious fervor. But the letter avoided the issue that has been at the fore for months, Iran's nuclear ambitions, and it was dismissed almost immediately by the White House. Meanwhile, a second letter from an Iranian official close to Ayatollah Ali Khamenei was sent to Time magazine and struck a very different tone. Jefferson Morley writes the World Opinion Roundup for the Washington Post Online. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
Let's start with the second letter for just a moment. Time magazine, isn't that an unusually public back channel?
I think it is. I think it's remarkable and a sign of some disagreement in Iranian ruling circles about the best way to proceed here. Unlike the president's letter, Rouhani's letter is phrased in diplomatic language, is a diplomatic opening. So I think that they're trying to signal that they want to talk.
Well, then let's get to Ahmadinejad's little missive. He's been portrayed in the U.S. press anyway as an amateur and pretty much a whack job. Are those characterizations showing up elsewhere in the world?
To some extent, yes. You don't have quite the edge that you have in U.S. commentary and the overseas commentary. And around this letter, Ahmadinejad really for the first time got some positive media, people crediting him with some skill in breaking the taboo on communications between the two governments and doing so at a time when the U.S. was failing to come up with agreement among the Western allies about how to approach Iran. Especially in the Gulf region, there was a feeling that the U.S. had missed an opportunity. This is from an editorial in the Arab News, which is a daily in Riyadh. They said, "In rejecting the letter so brusquely, Washington has shown a degree of diplomatic naivete. It may not have been an attempt to initiate dialogue with the U.S., but merely a diatribe against President Bush. Even so, it could have been used as a bridge for further contacts with Tehran. A carefully worded response on which dialogue could be built should have been the next step." The Gulf News, which is in United Arab Emirates, a little more of an independent news outlet, had very much the same line. At the same time, you also have a note in the foreign press of mistrust of Iran, and this is especially strong in those Persian Gulf countries, which are smaller than Iran and fear its revolutionary Shiite ideology. In Ashark al-Assad, which is another Saudi-funded paper published in London and read widely in the Arab world, the editor-in-chief wrote in response, "Iran's latest message confirmed the fears of those who see its actions as an aspiration for leadership. Iran seeks to control the region and the Middle East and become its policeman. This will lead to the breakdown of the peace process and the sabotaging of the Iraqi dream." I think that's the two themes that I'm seeing in the Middle Eastern press in response to the letter.
And what about the rest of the Muslim world outside of the Arab Peninsula? I mean, I noticed that Ahmadinejad got a very affectionate reception in Indonesia this week.
Yeah, I think that his uncompromising stance of standing up to the U.S. gets some positive reaction, and the Indonesians were clearly playing that up. A Turkish commentator on Friday said in the Lebanese Daily Star that Turkey's very concerned about the prospect of an armed conflict between the United States and Iran on its borders. So there's a short-term perspective of how do you get along with Iran, and a long-term perspective of is the United States going to war? In the Bahrain paper this week, a lead story is about, you know, would a U.S. attack on Iran be legal? You can't overestimate how much this question is beginning to preoccupy people.
Jeff, the U.N. Security Council has been divided on the kind of pressure it should apply to Iran as the tension about nuclear inspections grows. China and Russia continued to argue this week about sanctions. They think that they will alienate Iran even further. How did the press in Russia react to the letter?
In Russia, there's more of a range of debate around what really is Russia's core interests here. In the English-language Russian press, you get a variety of points of view. The main concern is they're not going to be a rubber stamp for the United States on this one. They have no interest in military action in Iran. In China, they follow the line of the government very closely. And the argument in the press there, in the sites like the People's Daily Online, is that even sanctions would be an unacceptable disruption of the world economy.
All right, Jeff. Well, once again, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jefferson Morley writes the World Opinion Roundup for The Washington Post Online.
Coming up, the high price politics pays for media consultation on both sides of the border.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This July, Mexican voters will go to the polls to elect a new president. 6 years ago, they broke decades of one-party rule by electing President Vicente Fox. Under Fox, the government has loosened its long-standing stranglehold on the media, especially at election time. But this year, Mexican voters have experienced a new phenomenon, negative advertising. It's a tactic that reflects the influence of political consultants who come from north of the border. From Mexico City, Colin Campbell reports.
This election season, three candidates are dominating the race for president. Roberto Madrazo has struggled in the polls, though his party held the presidency in Mexico for 71 years. Felipe Calderon is the candidate of the PAN, the party that made history by putting former Coca-Cola executive Vicente Fox in office in 2000. And Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the former leftist mayor of Mexico City, who until recently held a big lead in the polls. Two debates are being held during the campaign, and their format and content speak volumes about this evolving democracy. In the first so-called debate, the candidates stood at podiums in a TV studio with no audience. The moderator introduced a series of themes given to the candidates in advance. They had about 2 minutes to speak on each theme. There were no questions, no journalists, and little chance for the candidates to respond to each other. Even by the standards of U.S. presidential politics, this didn't qualify as a debate. It's a remnant of a corrupt one-party system that routinely squelched national debate. But overall, this year's campaign is offering a robust exchange of ideas. And behind that exchange, many political analysts here see the hand of U.S. political consultants. Media on both sides of the border cite rumors of everyone from Dick Morris to James Carville working for Mexican candidates. However, those mentioned either deny the reports or won't answer questions about them. Mexico's biggest step toward democracy took place during the last presidential election in 2000, when Vicente Fox prevailed over Francisco Labastida, a member of the party that ruled Mexico since 1929. Behind Fox's win, Rob Allen, a Dallas-based political consultant who made a name for himself helping George W. Bush become governor of Texas and designing a potent attack ad against John McCain in the 2000 GOP primaries. Rob Allen.
I think consultants who work in the largest democracies in the world have the ability and in some ways the responsibility to carry values of democracy in other countries.
As part of a larger campaign team, Allen and his staff helped shape Fox's message, coached him through TV appearances, created ads, and even chose his ties. His opponent, Labastida, was also guided by a team of U.S. consultants, including James Carville. But Allen successfully concealed his work from almost everyone, checking into hotels under false names, burning documents, and avoiding the press.
We did keep it quiet because, you know, I think if you're really putting the interests of your client first, then you shouldn't be out talking about the work that you do while it's still going on. It's not good for the consultant to become the issue. We're really not actors in this. We're just sort of moving scenery around on the set.
And maybe not just moving around scenery. Many media watchers here say U.S. consultants may also be writing the scripts.
Esto es intolerancia.
Presidente Fox, no se meta conmigo, caballero, porque sale espinado.
This is one of Mexico's first attack ads, which blanketed the airwaves in March. It shows Venezuelan hardliner Hugo Chavez threatening President Fox during a diplomatic spat, and then cuts to leftist candidate López Obrador telling Fox to shut up. Produced by Calderón's National Action Party, the ad drew on fears that Obrador could be an autocratic ruler in the Chavez mold. Prior to that ad campaign, Obrador had won front-runner status with retail politicking, traveling from one village to another with a populist message and a solid record as Mexico City mayor. But after the ads, polls showed a 20-point shift towards Calderón, and López Obrador lost his lead. Pollster Dan Lund has worked for Obrador in the past.
There have been dirty tricks, and there's been mean things said about each other in this country, but nobody's ever experienced the full flavor of a U.S. negative-type campaign. In order to resist that, any campaign consultant worth his or her salt in the United States would say, you need as much or preferably more money than the attacker, and you need a full-scale electronic media response.
Lacking that response, López Obrador was swept under. Pollster Francisco Abundis saw the impact play out in focus groups among once staunch Obrador supporters.
You can see voters in pain, which is very interesting and it's not very common. Is please give me an argument. You can see some type of anguish, and that's something that you don't see very often.
The anguish was caused in part by misleading messages. One ad exaggerated the debt López Obrador ran up as Mexico City mayor by a factor of 5. Eventually, federal regulators forced Calderón's party to pull 2 of the spots. Many media watchers here decry the ads as the direct and destructive handiwork of U.S. consultants. But Rob Allen, who declines to say whether he is participating in the current election, defends negative advertising as a hallmark of democracy.
Negative advertising is never popular. It's not popular here in the United States, and so we shouldn't be surprised that it's no more popular in Latin America or Asia or any place else where it's been successfully used. It does work in large part because it opens up the debate and allows people to debate back and forth the positives and the negatives of each candidate and each party.
But historians say the stakes are much higher than a few unpopular ads. Mexico has a history of violence and even murder during election season. That's one reason, many say, why the one-party system emerged and held power for so long. Sergio Aguayo, a political science professor at the Colegio de México, says he's not sure Mexico's democratic institutions are strong enough to withstand the polarization wrought by U.S.-style negative campaigns.
Mexico has incorporated the worst of American politics, dirty politics. That's not the kind of contribution that one could expect.
To political scientist and columnist Denise Dresser, this election will mark a new era in Mexican politics, the moment when candidates and voters witness the political power of TV advertising unleashed.
That's going to be the real question of this election. Is it still possible to win doing old-style politics of reaching out directly to the people and using party machineries rather than using the media?
If television is becoming key to winning the presidency here, then one-party rule may have been brushed aside only to be replaced by a hegemony of ad dollars. Voters will see more attack ads, and they will feel the side effects: more cynicism and less participation at the polls. So as Mexico moves forward into a more democratic future, it may find itself exchanging its political problems for some of ours. For On the Media, I'm Colin Campbell in Mexico City.
4 years ago, former Bolivian President Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada, known there as Goni, eked out a narrow re-election victory. It was due in part to the behind-the-scenes work of a group of Washington-based Democratic Party pollsters that included Tad Devine and James Carville. But it was a short-lived victory. Hardly were the votes counted before angry protesters took to the streets to denounce Goni's agenda. Dozens were killed in the ensuing violence, and a mere 14 months into his term, Goni fled to the U.S. It's a story documented in the new film Our Brand is Crisis, now making its way around the country. In this case, the outcome was, to say the least, unfortunate. But consultants from the North are hard at work throughout Latin America, and they're glad to be there. Just ask Mark Feierstein, one of the consultants who worked for Goni.
We've worked in Mexico, Argentina, Colombia, Peru, Dominican Republic, Panama. We're currently working in Venezuela and in Nicaragua and Honduras. It's probably better to ask where we have not worked.
How do you go about selecting the candidates you work for?
Well, we work for Democratic Party candidates in the United States. And we go overseas, we're looking for clients that embrace, you know, the values of the Democratic Party. These are people in Latin America, for example, who are committed to fighting corruption. People who support the free market, but believe that the free market needs to operate in a social context so that people gain as an economy grows overall. And that makes us unusual, to be honest, because there are many firms that, when they go overseas, tend to be less selective.
And so have you ever turned down any interested clients?
We turn down interested clients quite frequently.
Do you ever attempt wholesale makeovers? Do you make policy suggestions? Or is it a question of just tweaking what the candidate's already got?
Mostly it's working with what the candidate has. In most cases, the client has a particular philosophy, a particular agenda, and we're trying to help that client communicate that agenda and that philosophy with the electorate.
At least judging from the film, though, you do establish a theme for the candidate, and it might be a theme that the candidate himself or herself has never thought of.
The frame for us is, you know, crisis. I mean, we must be, that's our brand, as Stan was saying the other day, we must own crisis and we must brand crisis. Who can deal with it, who has the capacity to deal with it, and Goni as the guy who has strength, you know, in the plan.
That's obviously from the film. That's your associate, Tad Devine.
Right, that's Tad Devine, one of the best in the business. I mean, look, that message is consistent with who Goni is, consistent with his background. Someone who had created jobs, someone who had stabilized the economy. As a result of his success as Minister of the Economy, he was elected the first time. You know, we are proud of the role that we played in electing Goni, but the idea that consultants made Goni is, I think, erroneous.
How about negative campaigning? In the film, we see a member of your consulting team and an Israeli guy named Tal Silberstein telling Goni it's time to go negative against his opponent Manfred Reyes Villa. Here's a bit of that tape.
We have to make him from clean to a dirty candidate. That's our task. I had a discussion with Carlos Sanchez about it. Very personal. He has some stuff on him. He's going to do it through outside parties that are going to attack him. Is not going to come from us, at least that he's going to try start to feel the pressure. So I told him, everything you do, it cannot be connected to us in any way.
Okay, well, that's pretty bare-knuckled. Is that what actually goes on, and does it work?
You know, obviously there was one particular candidate there who had a history of corruption in his background, and that is something that voters were educated about throughout the course of the campaign. I think that's important. But the notion that foreign consultants were introducing the concept of negative campaigning would be erroneous. Campaigns tend to be much dirtier without the U.S. consultants, I think.
You think so?
No question, yeah.
Now, I have to assume that much of your experience of how campaigns work was gained through testing and honing of techniques north of the border. And I just wonder how these techniques differ north and south.
Well, first, there is a view that emotion is more important in Latin America. Having said that, I think it could be taken too far. I think some people tend to run campaigns that are empty of substance and they don't give enough credit to voters. We often find when we go overseas that our local research partner often prefers not to do research, prefers not to do focus groups among poorer voters. The sense is that they can articulate themselves in the same way that upper-class voters can. And we disagree with that strongly. You know, we've worked in some of the poorest countries in the world, for example, Cambodia, and we did focus groups in rural areas there, and we found people quite sophisticated in terms of their assessments of political parties, of candidates, of agendas.
Mexican President Vicente Fox, back in 2000, his American campaign consultants assumed Spanish-sounding names as they moved around the country, so it didn't get found out. Do you ever do that in your campaigns?
No, no one has ever called me Marcos. Look, we've never seen a voter that cared about who the consultant was for a particular candidate, a particular campaign. In fact, you know, some of the candidates who are most anti-American are the first ones to sign up American consultants. Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, is a good example. I mean, he engages in verbal confrontation with the United States on a daily basis, but he has American advisors. You know, again, it's an understanding that consultants in the United States tend to have extensive experience, extensive expertise, and we can perhaps, you know, raise the level of the campaigns we operate in. I mean, if the consultants were to disappear altogether, I don't think the character of the campaigns would change very much. You'd still have candidates and parties doing focus groups, doing polls, doing 30-second ads. That's just the nature of campaigning in the 21st century.
Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mark Feierstein is an associate vice president in charge of Latin American campaigns at the Washington consulting firm Greenberg Quinlan Rosner.
Of course, for U.S. political consultants, the biggest bucks are made here in the U.S. Walter Shapiro is the Washington bureau chief for Salon. He says that with the trend toward net roots fundraising, it's not just high rollers, but average earners who contribute to campaigns. And if they knew how much of their check was going to high-priced image makers, they just might close their checkbooks. So how much is going to the consultant? According to Shapiro, a media consultant for a candidate in a House race may get as much as 10 to 15% of the total spent on television ads. It's enough to break a candidate's bank. Walter, welcome to OTM.
Thank you, Bob.
In the piece is the suggestion, and this is an eye-opener, that had Al Gore in the year 2000 not had to dole out 15 cents or let's say, you know, so 10 cents on the dollar to political consultants, he might not have run out of money in Ohio weeks before the election, and that the results in that critical swing state could have been very different and the election outcome as well. Did his political consultant, Bob Schrum, cost the Democrats the White House?
I'm not going to say the greed per se cost the Democrats the 2000 election because they had to pull out of Ohio. But in a political campaign where resources are finite, the more money you spend on consultants, the fewer ads you can afford to put on television. And it is the ads that swing voters, not the big payments to consultants.
Now, you could make the argument that this is something that's sort of been hidden in plain view, But you note in your piece that the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, actually, while paying very strict attention to campaign receipts, pays almost no attention to campaign expenditures.
The Federal Election Commission rules allow a campaign to lump together their TV spending with the fees given to the media consultant. So one doesn't know if this is paying for 30-second spots attacking the opponent, or it's paying for a beach house for the consultant.
So what's the solution?
I wish I could just say, if we could only pass Regulation 673C to the Federal Election Commission Act, this would be solved. But much more importantly, it is a climate. And to a large extent, donors, particularly donors who understand that through the internet they can join with other donors, should have the right to ask campaigns, I don't care what the FEC requires, I want to know what percentage of the TV buy is going to your media consultant. And if the number is too high, there should be donor pressure for campaigns to renegotiate with their consultants. Because without trying to overplay the Howard Dean, you have the power line, in the case of the funding of campaigns in both parties, these people have rights, and they are not exercising their rights to make sure their money is spent well.
Reporters are reluctant to talk about this because the political consultants are also their best sources. Now, there's a conflict of interest. How serious is that problem?
Well, I think it's a real conflict of interest, and I'm not being holier than thou. It applies to me as well. This is a rare piece that I've done. The only really in-depth, multi-part newspaper series on how the consultants make their money was done in the Washington Post 6 years ago by Susan Glasser, a woman who was about to leave the political beat to report overseas from Moscow. So in other words, for the most part, the only reporting done on this is by people leaving the political beat.
Hey, how rich are these guys?
I don't know. I mean, two media consultants I consider are close friends, and I really cannot guess within $500,000 how much they make a year.
What do they drive?
Let's merely say that they live in very nice houses.
All right, Walter. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Walter Shapiro is the Washington Bureau Chief for Salon.
Coming up, battling speed bumps on the information superhighway.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows on September 20th. On the Media is supported by Live from Lincoln Center. On May 25th, Live from Lincoln Center broadcasts 30 years of Live from Lincoln Center, featuring clips from artists who have appeared on Lincoln Center's stages. Check local PBS listings. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A couple of months back, we discussed the prospect that one day the internet might be split into a fast lane and a slow lane. That's because the telephone and cable companies that supply us with broadband service believe they're getting a raw deal. They say that content providers ought to be willing to pay extra for the high-speed delivery that is now available to all, a state of affairs called network neutrality. Well, that fateful day may fast be approaching. Earlier this month saw the introduction of a House bill, soon to be followed by a Senate bill, neither of which include any real neutrality safeguards, though an alternative House bill does. If net neutrality is struck down, the anarchic internet could become rigidly hierarchical, and some of the services you depend on could slow to a relative crawl. Siva Vaidyanathan is a professor of culture and communication at New York University and a staunch defender of net neutrality, and he joins us now to explain the stakes in this debate. Siva, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
First, Siva, the issue of net neutrality, it's as dry as it is crucial. Lay it out with feeling.
The reason network neutrality is important is that if we want to keep cool services like YouTube or Facebook really powerful, cool ideas made possible by the even playing field of the internet, if we want to keep that culture healthy, then we want to make sure that there is something preventing these phone companies from discriminating and picking favorite companies over other ones.
But the fact is, internet service providers are being forced to satisfy the exploding appetite, both of us, internet users, and also content providers. And don't they have a point in saying people who use it more, whose demands are greater, ought to pay a higher price for that?
Well, you know, the question is not, of course, whether individual consumers should pay more, because we do. If we want faster service in general, we pay for it. The question is whether individual firms providing internet services are going to pay more. Now, this is what the phone companies aren't telling you. The whole reason that there is a market for broadband is that there are cool services, video services like YouTube, multiple sources of content like Google, internet phone services like Vonage and Skype. Those have created the very demand for broadband. If we didn't have that stuff, if every web page were static and text-based, if we just did email and instant messaging, we could all do very well with dial-up.
Fair enough. But now the demand is there, and AT&T and Verizon, among others, cable companies, are providing the pipes to that content. Why shouldn't they be able to profit as that market explodes?
Well, no one's arguing they shouldn't profit, and certainly no one's arguing that they don't profit. But what they're actually proposing doing is double billing. They want to charge me and you, consumers getting broadband service, a very high rate, and extort money from the service providers so that those willing to write the big check get their stuff delivered faster to you and me. That's not a fair business practice, nor is it really healthy for the sort of information and cultural environment and economic playing field that we really want to see on the internet.
I think what the phone and cable companies are saying is, look, we're not going to prevent this stuff from getting to you. They just have to pay for higher speeds. But you live and die by speed on the internet, don't you?
Well, especially if you look at the very services that threaten phone and cable companies, video delivery services like YouTube. I mean, that's a direct challenge to cable companies like Cox and Time Warner, and internet phone services like Vonage and Skype, which are providing really high quality audio, global phone calls for almost no money. Those companies threaten the core business of these older companies.
AT&T, Verizon, the cable companies have to maintain these physical plants. It's expensive. They have to constantly update. They have to do an enormous amount of service and billing and blah, blah, blah. Come on, you think they're just Dastardly Dan's tying Pauline to the railroad track?
Not at all. They're rational actors. I mean, they're doing exactly what any of us would do in that particular situation. They're trying to maximize the rents they can charge. They're trying to seek out any money-making opportunity and identify what they think are free riders in their system. And so, like any rational company, they've spent a tremendous amount of money on lawyers and lobbyists, and they have the ear of Congress. So that has tilted the debate. We, on the other hand, you and me, consumers, people who actually pay for this kind of stuff and would suffer by this radical change in the internet, we don't have lobbyists. Now, I still believe that if Congress and the FCC hear from enough Americans that we like how the internet has grown, then we might actually take some advantage of our power as voters.
Well, you've taken us to Washington, so let's stay there. There are a number of bills floating on Capitol Hill, including one this week in the House called the Communications Opportunity Promotion and Enhancement Act of 2006, or COPE. I've been reading about it. Some say it does offer a couple of protections for network neutrality. Others say it offers none at all. In any case, it is going to be decided behind closed doors, as will the later bill that's coming in the Senate, which apparently offers no protections for network neutrality.
Yeah, you know, the whole legislative array right now is very confusing, and it's actually intentionally confusing. But basically, what's going to happen is what all too often happens with these big telecom bills. They're going to have different versions passed in the House and the Senate. They're going to go to a conference committee. The conference committee is going to meet behind closed doors so that we, the people, get no clue as to who decides what or votes how. And then the House and Senate are going to be asked to approve a conference committee report coming out. There's a lot of question whether they can do all of this work before the end of this current session or whether they're going to hold it off till after the fall elections. But, you know, basically, there's a lot at stake right now. And so far, Congress has not heard the voice of the everyday consumer. They're basically letting the telecom lobbyists write the bills.
But isn't it hard to rally consumers around this issue? I mean, I think given the nature of the internet, it's kind of hard to believe that it really, despite whatever regulation you may try impose on it, that it can really be controlled.
There are a couple of different ways to look at this. There's the romantic way, right? The romantic way is that we want to have the internet as the wild frontier for entrepreneurship, and that's a strong case. There's also the liberal free speech argument, which says we want the internet to be a level playing field so a variety of voices can enter the public sphere. That's a fairly strong argument. But then you've got the economic argument, which is those of us who write checks every month to these companies, we want to be able to know that we are getting decent service for what we're paying. If my broadband company next week starts dialing down my Skype speed so Skype doesn't work as well for me, I might not even know it or notice it for a long time until Skype starts frustrating me. And out of frustration, I'm just going to pick up my old phone and dial India the old-fashioned way and just pay for it because I know the call is going to go through. That's the sort of frustration and opacity we might start seeing on the internet. So it is a service question, a competition question, an economic development question, a consumer question, and it really is dollars and cents.
All right. Siva, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Siva Vaidyanathan is an assistant professor of culture and communication at New York University. And now for a few of your letters. We received heaps of mail about Bob's commentary on Stephen Colbert's performance at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Most of the email writers agreed with Barbara J. Hewick of Eugene, Oregon, who wrote, "Dude, I can't believe you sided with the folks who called Stephen Colbert rude. Was the boy who pointed out the emperor's new clothes were non-existent rude? Bush is nude, baby. That the White House press corps had to have this pointed out to them by a comic is just sad. But it's their own fault for acting like courtiers."
But several writers understood and agreed with Bob's take. Adam D. Sperry of North Hollywood, California wrote, quote, "I wanted to thank you for your comments at the end of the show. You asked why the event even takes place the way it does. I was asking myself the same thing. Wring your hands about Colbert's performance if you must, but why was Bush or any sitting president on the dais anyway? There's something very wrong about the whole setup and not just the dinner."
Many in the anti-me camp did raise an interesting point. Adam wrote, "While Colbert's shtick may have fallen flat with the audience who saw it in person, the video clip has taken on a life of its own. I can't help but wonder whether he was really trying to perform for the White House press corps or whether Colbert's real intended audience was those of us who already are fans." Keep writing. We can take it at onthemedia@wnyc.org. The major TV networks have seen their share of turmoil in the past year. The three nightly newscasts now sport new faces. NBC, the longtime ratings king, has slumped to fourth place behind Fox, while CBS, a decade-long loser, has taken the lead. Bill Carter covers television for the New York Times. In his new book, Desperate Networks, Carter writes about the quirks of coincidence that can turn a show that seems dead in the water into a survivor.
They might as well put a blindfold on and throw a dart against a dartboard. In the case of Survivor, this British producer named Mark Burnett goes all over Hollywood, pitches the show everywhere to everybody, including every cable network, doesn't get anywhere. And his business manager knows not even an executive, but the executive assistant to an executive. So he calls that assistant on the phone and says, is there somebody around who would listen to this pitch? And then the guy looks in the cubicle next to him. And he turns to the guy and he says, you want to talk to this guy about this pitch? And this executive, whose name is Gen Maynard, says, well, sure, because he's looking for anything that'll get him out of this little cubicle. And the guy tells him about this show. It's about these people on an island. They pick who's going to get kicked off. And he's listening to this and he starts to think, when he went to Harvard, he majored in social psychology. And it sounds like a social psychology experiment to him.
Like this. Shane thinks I'm his puppy dog. He thinks he can tell me to do this and I'll do it, because up until this point I have, which really makes it easy for me to do things pretty inconspicuously.
So for the first time, just by happenstance, the guy has hit the right person to respond to this. Now, again, Maynard has the impetus to go and try to sell this to Les Moonves, the head of CBS. So he makes an appointment, and Les says, no offense, Gen, but that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard in my life.
Moonves eventually reconsidered, and the result of this little bit of cubicle happenstance is like a $1 billion franchise.
It's more than the franchise. It's the transformation of CBS into a network that actually had people under the age of 50 watching it. He gets young people, he gets old people, he gets kids, he gets teenagers. He even got Walter Cronkite watching. Walter Cronkite stopped him in the hall and congratulated him for bringing back the luster of CBS. And he liked that not as much as the call he got from his teenage daughter, who said, Dad, all my friends are watching a show on CBS.
There's an anecdote in your book about a very critical scheduling meeting when the people at CBS were making their final decisions about what would live and what would die. And they were about to announce a new show starring Tony Danza. One guy says, isn't it enough with this guy?
And I actually went and found that pilot because I had to see exactly what it was he reacted to. And it was just a remarkably conventional pedestrian television show about a guy who was a former New York cop who retires to the suburbs and then solves crimes with his kids. And it was just gratingly awful. And Les then is like, I wonder if there's something else. And he's almost like kicking the cassettes on the floor. Like, what else we got? What else is down here? Oh, what about this thing? And he puts it in. It's CSI. So from that moment, CBS gets at least $2 billion worth of revenue.
I want to ask you about the ecology of hits. We now can download hit TV shows on our video iPods. The phone and cable companies are making it possible to take the TV shows we love the most and see them on the third screen. In order to have that channel of revenue, the networks have to have hit TV shows.
Correct.
And as audiences shrink, where will the hit TV shows come from that will lead to the interest in downloading them on any of these portable devices?
That is really the critical question. I think the networks look to be moving toward a position of being like the movie's first weekend box office. They're going to be still the launching place for a lot of these hit shows, and then they're going to try to exploit them across different platforms. But they are going to still try to aggregate a gigantic number of people at least once. I mean, the problem they're having is that the bottom ends of their schedule are just doing nothing for them. They have no appeal at all.
So it's a chicken and egg proposition. In order to sustain the iTunes business, you need a hit show. But in order to get a hit show, you have to have a big audience. And in order to have a big audience, you have to trot out a lot of shows, most of which are going to fail. Who's going to pay to finance all of these shows in order to get the one hit so that you can watch it on your third screen in the subway car?
Yeah, that's a great question, because the advertisers have been paying, and it's been exclusively that single revenue stream. But obviously, they're trying to find revenue streams in those other platforms. So they charge $1.99 to download on the iPod. And ABC is putting their shows on their own website a day later and selling separate advertising, and that advertising that can't be skipped, which is a kind of an interesting thought. But essentially, the advertising revenue is going to diminish, so they need another outlet. They need the DVD sales, you know, and that does work with certain shows. If you have a serialized show like Lost or 24, they do great in the DVD sales.
The upfronts are beginning. This is the period where advertisers make their bets up front on the coming fall seasons. And some have predicted, and I guess I'm pretty much one of them, that this is going to be a doomsday moment for the networks. What's your prediction?
Well, the insiders in TV think that the upfront will actually be okay because Fox, ABC, and CBS are all in strong positions this year. Only NBC is in a terrible position. They all have hit shows that advertisers really want to be in. Because if you go to Fox and you say, I got to be an American Idol, and they say, fine, okay, but then you got to buy, you know, two spots in America's Most Wanted. And that's how they extract the money. So they've been able to do that. I think there is a crisis point coming. I'm not sure it'll be this year, but if another network starts to slump as badly as NBC has, and I think ABC has the potential, believe it or not, to be that network, it's almost like they're now on the precipice, and if they're holding on to these hits that are keeping them from falling over the precipice.
Now, you've written a few books now, and they're all filled with all this great dish. And I wonder, was there something you learned in this book that made you just go, whoa?
Well, I always knew that chance was the biggest player in all these guys' fates. But across the board, I mean, it's just incredible. There's an ABC executive named Lloyd Braun. He comes up with an idea about doing basically a fictionalized version of Survivor. People crash on an island, they have to form a society, etc. He then decides to bring in writers. The writer comes in, writes a bad script. Everybody thinks it should be dropped. But it's like his baby. He's got to pursue it. So he brings in a great writer named J.J. Abrams, and they come up with Lost. And it is a brilliant, fascinating idea. But ABC doesn't want to put it on because it's expensive, and it's attached to Lloyd Braun, who's now lost all his credibility at the network, so much so that they fire him. But he's so worried that this one show will die that he calls up NBC and tries to create a back channel to sell them the show that's still owned by ABC. And it didn't work. And he thought, oh, my gosh, there'll be no legacy of me and left at ABC. That doesn't happen. They do put it on ABC. It's a roaring, raging success. And the only thing that Lloyd Braun gets out of it is that very surreptitiously, they allow him to go into a studio one day and record three words previously on Lost. And that's his voice on the show. And that's his legacy on that. And that story really fascinated me.
Previously on Lost, currently the head of programming at Yahoo.
Correct.
All right. Well, Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob. I enjoyed it.
Bill Carter covers television for the New York Times. His new book is called Desperate Networks. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ani Katz and Mark Phillips. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org, the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. On the Media is supported by Live from Lincoln Center. On May 25th, Live from Lincoln Center broadcasts 30 years of Live from Lincoln Center, featuring clips from artists who have appeared on Lincoln Center's stages. Check local PBS listings. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.